Today we are going to talk about power. And power is a pretty timely topic for us in the world we are currently living in, as we are surrounded on all sides by various forms of power struggles. I mean, we see it every day, don't we? We see power struggles all the time. We see them when we're at the grocery store. I mean, have you ever come up with someone who you need to move and they won't move because they know you need them to move, and then you stay right there and then you just get in this grocery cart standoff? No? Well, maybe I'm the problem. We see it in traffic, don't we? Yes, there we go. I found one that works. We see it in traffic. I'm sorry, my microphone's going a little funky here. Hold on. Okay. We see it in traffic. People jockeying for a position. Sometimes I'm really amazed when I see a car fly by me on the freeway. And you know, you get off at the same exit as them, and you're right next to them. But let me tell you something. They proved something to you by getting there so much faster than you did. But besides all those little ways, we are seeing it so much today, politically, socially, economically, and we see power used to the benefit of the people that have power, certainly. And sometimes we see that power used against others. And I would say if there were a rule for power as we understand it here, we see power used to lift up those who have it and to tear down those who might take it away. We have a difficult relationship with power here. And the passages that we are going to cover today are full of displays of power. It's a different kind of power. It's a power that's displayed by Jesus. But there is an underlying question to these events that we are going to see kind of roll underneath the stories we are going to look at today. And that is, Jesus has power. He has a different power than people have ever seen or experienced before. But what is it that people want from him? What do they expect him to do with this power? Because make no mistake, people have expectations of Jesus. They know how they think he should use his power. And they know what they would do if they had his power. So everyone has his opinion. And at the bottom of this foundational question is, yes, what do people want, but how should his power be used? What is the best use of it? Now, we're going to do something a little bit different today. It's going to sound weird, but just bear with me here. You know my rules about how we go through the Bible stories, right? We're going to study chapter 4. What do we do first? We study chapter 3, because chapter 3 helps us understand chapter 4, just as chapter 5 helps us understand chapter 4. But today, we are going to change the order briefly. So we are just coming out of chapter 4. We are now going to go to chapter 6. I know! And then back to chapter 5. Let me tell you the reason why this is. Many scholars believe that these chapters are out of order, that 6 should have come before chapter 5. And there are some good reasons for this. Number one is the continuity and flow of what's happening. But there's an even more basic reason, which is geography. So in chapter 4, Jesus was in Galilee, which is way up north. In chapter 5, he's in Jerusalem. In chapter 6, he's in Galilee. And in chapter 7, he's in Jerusalem. Okay, why does that matter? It's a 120-mile trip on foot. That's why it matters. Which is why some have speculated that, well, maybe these things got out of order at some point. And This is not, by the way, the only time you've been exposed to an idea like this. If any of you have your Bibles open, you can turn over to John chapter 8. John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, tell the story of the woman caught in adultery. And in most of your Bibles, that story is going to be in italics. Now, that's not because the scribe wrote that story extra fancy, okay? That's not what's happening there. But the story is there because it was included when the gospel was put together, but not everyone is sure that that story actually happened like it did. And John is the only one to have that story there. So, all that just to say, we're going to do finish chapter 4 and then go to chapter 6, and then we will come back to chapter 5. And in the end, it will all make sense, or it won't, but we'll still be in the same place, so it's all good. So we're going to start in John chapter 4, verses 43 through 54. And last week where we left off, Jesus had this encounter with the Samaritan woman at the well. And it revealed to her that he is the Messiah. So they're still up there in Galilee, and here's where we're going to pick it up in verse 43. After the 2 days, he left for Galilee. He was in Cana at the time. Now, Jesus himself had pointed out that a prophet has no honor in his own country. When he arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, for they also had been there. Once more, he visited Cana in Galilee, where he had turned the water into wine, and there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son, who was close to death. Unless you believe signs and wonders, Jesus told him, you will never believe. The royal official said, sir, come down before my child dies. Go, Jesus replied, your son will live. The man took Jesus at his word and departed. While he was still on the way, his servants met him with the news that his boy was living. When he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 in the afternoon, the fever left him. Okay, well, let's clear up the geography things first, because even I got confused a little bit there. If you remember, he was in Jerusalem talking to Nicodemus in chapter 3, right? And he cleared the temple, and he did all those things. And then on his way back, he goes through Samaria, which is where he talks to the woman at the well. And from there, he went even further north, up into Galilee, to Capernaum and to Cana. Now, who is this guy that approaches Jesus? Well, we don't know. He is a royal official of some kind, which means he could have been a Gentile, he could have been a Jew, he could have been a centurion. He could have been a minor official in Herod's court. There are lots of possibilities for who he could be. The one thing we know about him is that he is somewhat important to whichever place he is serving. But more importantly than the fact that he's official is the fact that his son is sick. How sick is he? Very sick. And because this guy is an official, we can assume that when he was back at home with his sick son, he did everything within his power to make his son well. He used all of his resources, all of his contacts to try to make sure that his son got the proper care, and his son was still sick. In fact, his son was dying, and he had no options left. And so he hears about Jesus. And so he travels between 20 and 25 miles, hoping that Jesus would be able to save his son from death. And there is one reason why he is there, right? My son's dying. I need you to do something about this. Now, given that that's where this guy is coming from, Jesus' response seems a little bit strange. Doesn't it? If you look back in verse 48, Jesus says, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never believe. So he comes to ask for healing for his son, and Jesus gives him a short lecture on faith. That seems a little bit of a weird reply, doesn't it? to a father that is there so that his son might die? And, you know, honestly, I don't love that response. It's not my favorite response of Jesus to something that's going on. The man's son was dying, and Jesus spoke to him like the man was asking him to do some sort of trick in order to prove something to him. Where's the compassion for this desperate man? Well, as we're going to see, there is more going on here than what we see with just this man and Jesus. And the man, to his credit, ignores what Jesus just said. Jesus didn't say yes or no, so he reminds him, cool, heal my son now, please. And his response is very clearly like, cool, I don't have time for this. If we don't do something now, and, you know, he's 20 to 25 miles away, so can we just, let's walk and talk, shall we? Let's get there and solve this problem. And Jesus' response was what? Go, and your son will live. Is this a test for the man? On some ways, we might say yes. Because what Jesus is asking him to do is to decide right in that moment whether he believes Jesus is capable of this or not. We have to think that he already believes that, right? After all, he did travel all that way to grab Jesus and bring him back to his sick son. But in this moment, he has to decide. And what Jesus does here is he complicates it in a subtle but important way. You know, Jesus going to see his son and healing his son is a miracle. That's why he's there. He needs that miracle. But for Jesus to simply speak 25 miles away from his son and his son to be healed, well, that's sort of different, isn't it? I mean, as much as we might understand, it's miraculous, but he's there and he puts his hands on him. Can Jesus possibly speak a fatal illness out of existence in this person from 25 miles away? And the guy has to decide what? Do I go? Do I insist he come with me? And to his credit, he did not question Jesus, he just left. If this is what it takes for this to happen, I will go. I'll go right now. And it tells us something important that is Jesus, or John here in this case, our author, is trying to tell us about people's responses to Jesus and his power. The man's son was healed. In fact, the fever went away at the exact moment Jesus said his son will be well, proving that it was Jesus who healed the boy. Not that this was ever in doubt. But John puts that in there so that we know, hey, he didn't just get better on his own. It was Jesus who made this happen. But we see something here about faith. And that is, if people are going to catch on to what it is that Jesus is doing, faith is a part of it. They are going to have to believe in him. And the hard thing about that belief, the hard thing about that faith, is that we need sometimes proof to believe in things, don't we? We do. We need proof to believe in things and to step out. And Jesus gives us this uncomfortable thing here that says that belief in him, faith in him, means you're going to have to do some things that are not going to make sense to you. But if you believe that Jesus is who he says he is, you will go. Look, Jesus wanted people to believe in him, and he knew all too well that signs and wonders are what people are looking for. But Jesus doesn't want to be a magician, does he? He doesn't want to entertain people. He wants to bring the truth of God to the world. John wrote this gospel so that people will believe Jesus is the Son of God. But here's the problem again, right? How do you prove to someone that Jesus is the Son of God? What will it take for you to believe? What will it take for there to be enough proof? What will be enough for you? How far should Jesus have to go to change one mind and one heart? And in this one brief story, we see that tension come to the surface. You guys want me to do all these things, and you're saying you won't believe in me until I do these things, signs and wonders. So let's look at the next one from John chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. You've probably heard this story before. It's the feeding of the 5,000. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. Let's pause for a second. John said this again at the end of that, or at the beginning of that passage we just read from chapter 4, and he's saying it again here in chapter 6. The signs and wonders that Jesus is doing are causing what to happen? People are following him. So they are actually signs that are pointing to Jesus. They are things that people have never seen before, and this is drawing people to Jesus. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he had already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there, so not even counting the women or children. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. That's a really funny sentence right there, if you think about it. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who has come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Okay, some things I want us to unpack there. Again, number one, the people are there because Jesus is there, and Jesus had been doing all these amazing things, and so these people have come out. And at this point, it's not a few people, it's a lot of people. And Jesus sees how many people have come out to be around him there that day by the Sea of Galilee, and he says, "We should feed these people." They had been following him around, and he wanted to take care of them, but there was just one little problem. There was a lot of people, and to feed that many people, you need a lot of food. To buy that much food, you have to have a lot of money. And the disciples are like, "We don't have that kind of scratch, man. There is no way we can feed all of these people. In fact, it would take 6 months for wages for everyone to have a bite. How much then would it take for everyone to eat their fill?" Multiple years, we can assume, of income. And here's my favorite part of the story. All these thousands of people are out there by the Sea of Galilee, away from town, and there is one child who came prepared. Out of all of these people. And he brought, what? 5 small loaves of barley. Don't get caught up in that loaf word, okay? They are small loaves and 2 small fish. Yes, John uses the word small twice to make sure we understand there is food, but there is very little food. A preposterously small amount for the number of people that are there. Jesus, however, is nonplussed by the whole situation because John tells us he already knew what he was going to do. And what was it that he wanted to do? Well, he took this food, these 5 small loaves and these 2 fish, he gave thanks to them, and then he started distributing the food. 5 small loaves, 2 fish. I have questions. Anyone else have questions? We should. How did this literally work? You have this finite amount of food, and he's passing it out. Where is it coming from? Is it multiplying in the kid's lunchbox as he's passing it out? Is Jesus, like, you know, pulling a fish out from behind his ear? I want to know. What's going on here? Where is this coming from? And there was so much food that everyone ate as much as they wanted. They ate until they were full. So Jesus is pulling fish and loaves out of this bottomless basket, apparently, that is being taken around to all of these thousands of people. And Jesus then, at the end, because he's just showing off at this point, says, why don't you go back and collect the leftovers? The leftovers from the 2 fish and the 5 small loaves. And they bring back 12 baskets of food from the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. It is preposterous, impossible to imagine the working of this. I can't wrap my mind around them, around these facts. It is truly an amazing story. And there's a lot of things we can pull out of the story. By doing this, you know, Jesus showed his disciples that he can provide for all of anyone's needs. Even if providing for those needs seems impossible, Jesus can do it. That there is nothing outside of his reach. The mere thought of multiplying items like that to feed everyone around is crazy, but check out the end. Did people believe in Jesus because of these things? Yes, they did. And Jesus looks at them, because he's also got the Jedi mind stuff going on. He looks at them and he knows they believe in him. He also knows what? Because he has this kind of power, because he can do these things, they want him to become king. A specific kind of king. And they were going to force him to do it. So what does Jesus do? He just peace outs the whole situation. Nice to see you. Glad you were here. And he's gone. Now, what is it that the people were thinking? Well, Moses had predicted that a prophet like him would arise. And Moses had fed the people with bread from heaven. And Moses had led them out of bondage. So what's the most direct comparison point they have when they're seeing these things happen? Jesus is like Moses. He can feed a vast number of people with very little and miraculous ways. He should be our king and he should lead us out of Roman bondage. Would that have been a good thing? I mean, let's just talk sort of objectively for a second. Theoretically, would the Jewish people having their freedom and not being under Roman bondage be a good thing? sure, it'd be fine for them, right? The reason why I bring up that question is that sometimes when we look at the intentions of people as we understand them, we tend to really say, oh, well, that's so shallow, or that's so this, or they shouldn't have thought this, or they shouldn't have thought that. But you have to understand, these people had been waiting for generations for someone to come and set them free. They are not bad people because they think this. They really aren't. What's the problem then? Their understanding of how the power of God should be used in the world was not, in fact, how God wanted his power to be used in the world, whether it was good or bad. And therefore, when Jesus catches on, he leaves. Because he's not going to be in a position, put into a position, where he has to tell them, no, 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 I'm not going to be dragged up to the throne. So where did he go when he left? Funny you should ask. Because, you know, after he left, he ended up just kind of like walking across a lake. From chapter 6, verses 16 through 24. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on water, and they were frightened. But he said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Cool. Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but that they had gone away alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. Okay, funny story all the way around here in the Gospel of John. Number one, it almost feels like a side note, doesn't it? Jesus walking in water. We don't have all the stuff with Peter jumping out of the boat and this is what faith and like all that sort of stuff. We don't have any of those things. John keeps the story short and it's almost functional, right? Well, Jesus had to get from here to here. How do you think he'd get from here to here? Well, good question. The situation was not a great one for the disciples. Jesus had gone up on this mountain. They didn't know where he was, and so they know that they're supposed to go over here, so they get in this boat and they go over here. But the west wind, which often picks up in the evening on this lake, caught the disciples in the open water, and they were rowing directly into wind, which is not an easy thing to do. In fact, they were making so little progress that it was almost like they were just stuck there, fighting against the wind. And guess what happened every time they stopped rowing? The boat went backwards, right? Now, the Sea of Galilee is noted for its sudden and severe storms. And get this, they had already rowed 3 or 3.5 miles. So they're roughly in the middle of the lake. And they're stuck there. They can't get any further. And they look up, and what do they see? Jesus walking, apparently, 3 miles on the water. Can you explain this? Because Jesus was still in the shallow water. No. Can you explain it in other ways? People have certainly tried. But they see this, and they think it might be a ghost. And this happened at sometime between 3 and 6 in the morning during the fourth watch. I have questions. All right? What are the logistics of this? Did the water turn solid under his feet? Did the bottom of his feet or even his sandals like blow up with air so that he was like sort of like, how did this work? I mean, at some point there has to be some sort of, is he just simply floating on the water? Well, no, they tell us he's walking. He's not hovering over the water. He's walking on the water. But it's kind of funny how little attention John gives to the story. It feels very much like a transitional moment. He's literally on his way from one place to the other. But don't miss the end, because in this story, you know, these eight verses, only four of them are about him walking on water. So only half of the passage is about that. What's the other half about? People realized he was gone. They did some little detective work, and they decided to chase him in boats so that they could find him and follow him again. And the assumption would be that they're going to do what Jesus knew they were going to do after he fed them. They are going to find him and take him back to become their king. Now, this entire subject leads us to an important dialogue that we're going to get to next week. But until we get to that, I want us to reflect on the power that Jesus has and how it is starting to shape the story that John is telling us. Because here's the thing. Some people don't want Jesus to have power, like those who run the temple. Because if Jesus takes power, they will lose power. Some people want Jesus to have power, but a power that he uses in a certain way, to benefit their people and to lift them up over their enemies. But Jesus has another plan. And to Jesus, it doesn't matter who doesn't want him to have power, and it doesn't matter what people want him to do with his power, because who is directing Jesus to do what he does? God is. And where is Jesus' power from? It's from God. And we are seeing in real time in the story how what people want God to do with his power versus what God wants to do with his power butt heads. They're not the same thing. Why does this matter? Well, we have to understand what we have here. Is Jesus king? Yes, he is. He is king. He is the Messiah. He is the Son of God. What does it mean then for him to be king, and what does it mean for him to have power? And here's the expectation. And it's built on how we still today view power. We have a model for how power is used in the world. When someone has power, they use that power to benefit themselves, those closest to them, how they think the world should work. They use the power to influence things the way that they want them to go. Look at the kings from biblical history, okay? Some of the kings were good. Most were bad. They all had power to some degree, and that power was used in different ways. But almost always the power found its way to be self-serving, so that the king benefited from whatever it was. You think about David, who did a lot for the people, who built the kingdom, led them to victory in so many ways, and he rose his people up, raised them up, but he also used that power to steal someone else's wife and have that man killed. Why? Because he could. You think about Solomon, the king after David, who led Israel to tremendous prosperity. He also had 700 wives and 300 concubines. You need a lot of loaves and fish for those folks. But the thing is, this is not a surprise, because this is how the world works. This is how power is used. And it's how it's used every single day, in ways that we are used to, in ways that we see and don't really even understand anymore. How many times in human history have kings justified going to war, killing others so that they could have more power? Why do we have conquerors? Why do we have Alexander the Great? Why do we have Rome? Because power wants more power, and it wants it for itself. The people know that Jesus has power. So what do they expect him to do with it? They expect him to become a conqueror. They expect him to do what they would do, to defeat their enemies, to raise them up. And the reason why they think that is because this is, in fact, how it works. This is what you do with it. And when Jesus recognized this in their eyes, he took off. Because here is the reality. The truth is that Jesus had more power in his pinky nail than any other king had ever had. It wasn't even close. Take this as a comparison. You know what this is, right? It's a battery. Okay? And what does a battery do? It stores power. And you use that power to power things, right? So this is the equivalency of what our power is like. Whoever, you could put a bigger battery up here if you want, okay? And that's the amount of power that we have. Well, guess what? This has to get power from somewhere, doesn't it? Right? So these are rechargeable batteries. And they have power within them, but when their power runs out, they have to go get it from the wall. And the power that's coming from the wall is unfathomable to this battery. You get that? So it might think it has power, but does it actually have power comparatively? No. I mean, think about this. Solar panels have batteries, and they're powered by the stinking sun, right? What's the comparison here? They're clearly not the same. The truth is that Jesus had more power because his power was not earthly power, which can be given and taken. His power was from above. His power was from God. And here's the thing that we have to wrap our minds around in the world we live in today is that the power of God has different rules than we do. And it will not operate in the same way. Because get this, when Jesus was here on earth, did he have enemies? Yes. Well, Jesus didn't come to defeat those enemies. He did not come to crush the religious leaders, the enemies of Israel. He did not come to set himself on a throne as the head of a nation. They want him to defeat Rome. Do you know how funny it must have been to Jesus to talk about the power of Rome? The greatest power in the world. He had nothing to prove in defeating Rome. And this is part of what makes him so different. Because Jesus became the kind of king no one has ever seen before. The king that has vast power, can do whatever he wants, can put anyone under his feet, and instead, he sees a crowd that's following him, and what does he want to do? Feed them. He's a king that speaks to the mighty and the lowly equally, the teacher of teachers and the scorned woman who is hiding from the rest of the town. He came not to just raise up the strong, but to show his mastery over sickness and physical limitations, regrowing limbs on people. He came to show mastery over all those things, over demons, over the enemies in the world. When you think about it, there is actually nothing that stands against him in the gospel stories. Jesus doesn't lose, ever. And here is the most remarkable thing. That vast, unbeatable power chose, through sacrifice, a willing gift from the King of the universe, to show his power in the way that the power of God should be used. He does not accumulate it or hoard it for himself. Instead, this power gives, loves, redeems. And that, my friends, is true lasting power. It's the power of God. And thank Jesus that while we would have used this limitless power to lift ourselves up over others, God uses it to redeem. And so there's something I want us to consider here today. There is a lot of talk in our country, in the world we live in now, about the influence that Christianity should have on the world. And that talk has gone into how Christianity should determine what people think or do or how they act. And I know that all of these issues are very difficult and hard issues. So by no means am I trying to minimize them. But I want you to know, if we are approaching the power of God in this world as a way to control others, we're off base. We are. And the power of Jesus should never be used to subjugate someone else. You hear me on that? Because that's not what it's for. And that, my friends, is really good news, isn't it? It is. That God chose to redeem us, his enemies, those who stood against him, instead of crushing us. And that he did this willingly, lovingly, compassionately, because ultimately God could do nothing else but love us as we are. Praise God for that. And isn't it wonderful that all this power we've talked about that can do all of those things, that its greatest form is actually found in the love for us? Isn't that wonderful that that's who our God is? People are going to continue to struggle with him throughout this story. They're continue to want him to do and to be different things. But Jesus shows us through all of the things that he is how much God loves us.